I'm Christopher Leiden. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation, we call it, with global attitude. This one's about the art and science of writing, the lure and the pleasure of reading microhistory, as it is known, the unfolding of obscure and antique events about nobodies that open up like a time capsule and spill out the human flavor of folk religion in the 16th century on the outskirts of Venice, or the life and death and church and legal implications of wet nursing the babies of prostitutes in Bologna a century ago. I'm sitting with two celebrated practitioners of microhistory, microhistorical giants, so to speak. Carlo Ginzburg, I've been tracking you for years on the trail of your famous and influential book with that unforgettable title, The Cheese and the Worms. And David Kurtzer, the provost of Brown University, who made a literary trade book hit this year with Amalia's Tale, the story of the wet nurse who got syphilis from the foundling in her arms, and the story of her lawyer who made, in effect, a malpractice case of it in the 1890s. Carlo Ginzburg, maybe the best way for people who haven't read microhistory is simply to ask you how you found that story of the miller, known as Minocchio, who was burned by the Catholic Inquisition for his theory of the earth and life on it as a system of cheese and worms.
Well, I mean, I was working in Friuli, and I was working on a different topic. I was working on witchcraft, actually a sect of counter-witches in Friuli in the 16th and 17th centuries. And then I was looking at a list made by an inquisitor in the 18th century, and so I was reading the list, and I came across a short description of a trial involving a man, a miller, who believed that the world was comparable to rotten matter, rotten cheese. So I took a note, but I was looking for something else. And so this note remained unused for years.
Well, when did it occur to you that there was a whole, in effect, a movie script here of a curiously modern man? It's the dawn of printing. We're well into the Reformation and the Counter-Reformation, and the church is coming down very, very powerfully on the little people. You also reveal, I should say, this fascinating folk religion in the backyard of the Vatican. But when did you realize that, in a sense, everything was here?
At that moment, it was not obvious to write such a book. In other words, to turn, let's say, a footnote into a book. Mm. And so I think that I succeeded in making a larger point when I discovered that between the way in which Minocchio di Milla remembered what he read and the actual written, printed page, there was a gap. And the gap was related to Minocchio's oral culture. In other words, it's the intersection between the oral and the written culture, which, in my view, allowed me to make a larger point about, let's say, Minocchio sharing a larger phenomenon, something related to popular culture, but something related to popular culture in its intersection with written culture. So the idea that, let's say, the relationship between the elites and the underprivileged classes implied some kind of circularity is the point which I tried to make in this book. I mean, the word microhistory actually started to be circulated some years later, just a few years later. Actually, not by me, but I think there is a sort of misunderstanding about microhistory. In other words, microhistory is not about, let's say, unknown, forgotten people. This was certainly the case with Minocchio. But I think the point about microhistory is related to microscope. In other words, it's the analytic approach which is crucial in this kind of historiographical approach. In other words, you may put under a microscope either, let's say, the leg of a flea or the fragment of the skin of an elephant. It's the analytic element which is crucial. For instance, when Giovanni Levi, my friend who is also a historian, very much involved in microhistory, and myself, we started a series called Microhistories, one of the first volumes which we published was my own book on Piero della Francesca, who is certainly an elephant, is not a flea, you know. And so I think that this analytic element is absolutely crucial. In other words, that's the reason why I used to say that microhistory is in fact about generalizations, which is a sort of counterintuitive remark. It's not related to a sort of a cult for fragments. Now, I personally was, and I still am, extremely dissatisfied with most historical generalizations. And so the idea is to take a sort of analytic approach in order to provide a basis for better, more convincing.
No, I take that. We'll come back to the matter of evidence, the Sherlock Holmes connection, so to speak. But I love the emphasis on microscope, not in the sense, not just the smallness of micro. Mm. When I read Dostoevsky, I feel I'm looking at a microscope, through a microscope. Mm. I mean, there's that same kind of intensity of focus on tiny things. Mm. David Kurtzer, you're in the next generation and centuries later, but playing the same game in Amalia's Tale, which I hugely admired. Again, this is a court record in relatively modern times, but how did you find it? And how many more could let an historian recreate a society as you did in Amalia's Tale?
Well, the story is somewhat similar to Carlo's in that I was doing a broader scale study of, in this case, the abandonment of infants, newborn babies in Europe in past centuries, particularly the 19th century. And when I was working on this, which was back in the late 80s and early 90s, I came across this particular case. It was a case of a woman who contracts syphilis from a baby she's given, a foundling from the foundling home. She takes home, begins to nurse, and the baby develops syphilitic symptoms. She contracts syphilis. And a dramatic series of events then follow. What's unusual about this case
is the wiping out of her family, really, right?
Well, she, as this was turned out to be typical, these cases were known to a certain very limited group of people involved in foundling homes back in the late 19th century, throughout the 19th century, but they were hushed up for a variety of reasons. And what was unusual about this case is this particular peasant woman found a lawyer, times were changing, to defend her and to, in fact, lodge a civil suit against the foundling homes, the hospitals of Bologna, and it would lead to a several-year court case that ends up in the Italian Supreme Court. But to get back to the, you know, how this case came to my attention, I was doing the more general study, found this case, and I think another thing we have in common in terms of some of Carlo's work is often it is legal records that are left behind that allow you to get into these people who otherwise are leaving no written trace of their own. And a very important thing to consider is until the 20th century, a great majority of people were illiterate. And so there is a problem in historiography that so much of history is written about the people who leave records behind. And social historians generally back in particularly this period of the 1970s, 80s, and microhistory became part of this, became concerned about the disproportionate historical attention that elites got and the fact that our understanding of the lives of the great multitudes was so limited. So in Carlo's case, if you take religion would, so much of it was defined by the records of the Holy See and clergy and other elites, but what popular religion was like became much less the terrain of most historians. So these, among other things, are kind of methodologies for getting at that larger historical terrain. So in coming across that case, I wrote a broader book about this problem, came out, I think, in 93. But I had this case was gnawing at me, this case of this woman, Amalia, who contracts syphilis. And being influenced by works like Cheese and the Worm and Worms and Carlo's other works and Natalie Davis, Return of Martin Guerre and others, I did see this as a strategy for getting at something that my more general book couldn't get at.
The Return of Martin Guerre also realized the cinematic kinship here. Let me ask you, though. I'm interested in what microhistorians say to each other. I'm interested in where the next troves of documents will be dug. But I'm also interested in our own mysterious world. Where would the microhistorian tell us to be looking for the best evidence of what's up? How would all of us reconfigure our scope about our own society on these instincts?
Well, I think my answer is going to disappoint you, because I think my attitude is there are no blueprints, there are no recipes. But there is something which can happen looking at a sort of unexpected or expected, but most usually unexpected piece of evidence, and you say, ha-ha. So it's this ha-ha, which is unpredictable by definition, which can lead, in some cases, to something larger, more interesting. One has the feeling that a piece of evidence is promising, but in which direction? Well, we don't know. So, in that sense, I would be unable to make predictions. The crucial evidence for a sort of breakthrough can be found in very unexpected places.
Suggest a couple.
I mean, it could be, let's say, a diary, but it could be also, let's say, a debate in a public space, in a Senate. Why not? I mean, I'm a devout reader of Edgar Allan Poe, and so the purloined letter provides a strategy. The most obvious, most hidden place is that table.
I want to quote you a wonderful paragraph in an essay you wrote called Clues, about standards and criteria of evidence going back to the Stone Age or before. This is what you wrote. Man has been a hunter for thousands of years. In the course of countless chases, he learned to reconstruct the shapes and movements of his invisible prey from tracks on the ground, broken branches, excrement, tufts of hair, entangled feathers, stagnating odors. He learned to sniff out, record, interpret, and classify such infinitesimal traces as trails of spittle. He learned how to execute complex mental operations with lightning speed in the depth of a forest or in a prairie with its hidden dangers. And so, since then, the process is mechanized, arguably refined with fingerprinting, iris scanners now that can search a whole stadium of people. But as you say, the hunter would have been the first to tell a story because he alone was able to read in the silent, nearly imperceptible tracks left by his prey a coherent sequence of events. What may be the oldest act in the intellectual history of the human race is the hunter squatting on the ground, studying the tracks of his quarry. I love that.
Well, I mean, the reception of this passage has been quite unpredictable because, it fascinated both writers like Italo Calvino and narratologists. The idea that, this was the origin of telling a story was something which intrigued many people. And, one could say, but is this history? And I would say, well, this is a piece of conjectural history according to 18th century standards. So it's a conjecture, but likely, highly likely. And then I think there is a sort of model for, describing what we historians sometimes, not always, not everybody, but what we can do with evidence. And then, this metaphor should be put into practice, and then we should try to unfold its implications. For instance, what is the role played by the hunter's cumulative knowledge? Because, in front of a footprint, he's able to say, well, this is a deer, and so on and so forth. So the role played by the series in order to identify the meaning of a single footprint is something which can be transferred into the vocabulary of the historian. Because we need both the series and the individual footprint or the individual document, So, it's endless.
In that same essay on clues, you connect three models for what the microhistorian is up to. Sherlock Holmes, Sigmund Freud, and an art historian of the 19th century, Giovanni Morelli.
Right.
Piece that out. One's a doctor, one's a detective, one is a kind of he's trying to dope out the dates of paintings and the authenticity.
Yeah, but he also had a sort of medical education because he studied in Munich, and so actually I suggested that there is a sort of semiotic pattern which is related to semiotics in the medical sense. I mean, to identify symptoms of an illness. After all, the very word historia, which means description in Greek, was used both by historians and by doctors. It's the history of an illness. We still use this word in that sense. Actually, a great historian who taught me a lot, Arnaldo Momigliano, wrote an essay on history between medicine and rhetoric. And I think this is a very good point.
Well, there's a medical thread really running through all of this.
Yeah, that was my argument. In other words, the fictitious character, Sherlock Holmes, in a way shared something which we can also find in the case of Sigmund Freud and Morelli. By the way, Freud read Morelli. Actually, a book of his is of Morelli is still in Freud's library. Morelli was a brilliant character. I mean, his point was that in order to identify an original of an old master as distinguished by copies, we should look for minor details. That was the point which fascinated Freud. Earlobes, nails. So there was something stereotypical about smiles in Leonardesque paintings, copies of Leonardo, but, I mean, earlobes betrayed a sort of handwriting. That was Morelli's point. And so some unconscious element, gestural element, went to the surface. And actually Freud said in a footnote of his essay on Michelangelo's Moses that psychoanalysis was deeply indebted to Morelli.
Well, I learned from you that Freud himself made the connection with this spirit of microhistory when he spoke early on of what would become psychoanalysis. He saw in Morelli's work a method for mining the rubbish heap, as it were, of our observations.
Well, I would say that, let's say, Freud's cases are highly significant, in my view, because they provide a sort of model for dealing with a case in a micro-historical perspective.
Can I ask you, David Kurtzer, there's something teasingly therapeutic or healing about this whole microhistorical undertaking, it seems to me. And it's this medical connection. It's a new definition of relevant evidence, or relevant people, ways to tell the truth.
Well, there's certainly the detective aspect, and the Sherlock Holmes is part of it. And you're talking about the tracks that the hunter interprets. So on the one hand, you've got very fragmentary evidence, and then you come up with a narrative. And you know, that's maybe the magic of a lot of history, and certainly of microhistory. I think readers often don't appreciate, they somehow think their narrative is just somehow inherent in the evidence, but of course they're both elements. So on the one hand, there's the, at least from the historian's point of view, the satisfaction of finding things in archives, that, and you never know what you're going to find, and most often perhaps you're disappointed. But sometimes you go to a place thinking, well, probably there'll be nothing, and then you find, you know, the key letter or the key documents that put everything in a wholly different light. And then, of course, you take these fragments you've gotten from very different places and try to find a way as a historian to write the story, to tell the narrative, to put it together. And so there, I think, is the joy, certainly for the historian, and hopefully that's passed on through the narrative to the reader.
But is there an impulse, as in Freud's case, to heal us, or to correct something?
Well, in that book, for example, the Amalia's Tale book, I was interested in illuminating what I thought was a very important part of European and Italian history, namely the mass abandonment of newborn babies. I mean, the mid-19th century, in a place like Milan or Florence, one out of every three babies was left at a foundling home. It goes against all notions people certainly in the U.S. have, but maybe Italy also, about the Italian mama and the Italian family. So there was a kind of paradox here that I wanted to shed light on. You know, one of the challenges of writing a book like this, to how do you illuminate the larger history without being pedantic and keeping people into the narrative of the very particular.
Well, the triumph of both of your work, it seems to me, is not a page of your histories sound trivial or arcane. You build out, with novelistic skills, I think, a very large canvas. Carla, I want to go back to something you wrote, that the skills of a microhistorian, you say, are built on the conjectural disciplines, and they must include the flexible and rigorous, I like that, flexible and rigorous insights of a lover, of a horse trader, or a card shark. I love the idea of watching the evidence the way poker players look for tells, so-called, in the people they're playing with. But give an example or two out of your own history of what the card shark sees, the horse trader, or the lover.
Yeah. David stressed, and I totally agree with him, the fact that there has been a sort of discovery of the larger relevance of judicial records, especially for early modern European history. In the case of Natalie Davis Martin Guerre, she was unable to find the trial, but she was able to use a reflection on the trial made by the judge himself. So it's a sort of more remote, but still related to judicial records kind of evidence. Now, if we are dealing with transcripts, like, inquisitorial trials, or so we have a dialogue. And so the point is to decipher the implications of minute details. Now, sometimes the historian is actually following in the footsteps of the notary or of the inquisitor. So, for instance, there is a moment in which Menocchio is silent. This silence has been recorded, So, there is a sort of guesswork which has been made by the notary, the inquisitor, and now by the historian. How is it possible to decipher that silence? I mean, it's something like an hesitation in a card game or in the interaction between two people, two lovers. So even a silence can be recorded. That for me was something astonishing, because it's the most fleeting element, but is there.
But David, you surely contributed kind of novelistic emotional detail in Amalia's tale that wasn't there in the record, right?
Well, this gets at a real issue for if you're trying to write history for a broader audience, which, there are different ways of doing this, and at the same time talk particularly about illiterate peoples who leave fragmentary kind of evidence behind, there's often a disjunction. Amalia's tale is about this illiterate 23-year-old peasant woman from the mountains. I write this whole book about her, but I don't know what she looks like. I know some of her medical problems, but I don't know, what color hair she had or how tall she was. Now, I didn't choose to invent that, so one could have, to make the book more readable,
You describe the skin of her breast.
Right. But that was from, in fact, the testimony of the doctors who had examined her at the time. It's a very fine line that if you can't be believed, or that the reader can't believe that what you're saying is based on firm evidence, then it's no longer history. An earlier book I had written, I remember, got a review. This had to do with, based on records of the Inquisition, but a case in Bologna involving a Jewish child who was taken from his parents because the local inquisitor had heard reports he had been secretly baptized and believed, therefore, that according to church dogma, a Christian child could not stay with a Jewish family, so this child had to be taken from his family.
Remarkable book, I should say, The Kidnapping of Edgardo Mortara, right?
Yes, and there's an opening scene in the book where The police come to the door to take the child, and I say the mother gets up from the table and opens the door and so on. And one of the reviewers, luckily most reviewers were kinder than this reviewer, but the reviewer writes, this is one of the major London newspapers. The problem with Kurtz's method is he just invents material to make the book more readable. For example, he has the mother getting up from her kitchen table surrounded by her children and answering the door. Well, he couldn't possibly have known that. But I would never have said that except for the fact that in her testimony later at the trial of the inquisitor for kidnapping, she says, I got up from the kitchen table, went to the door, and so forth. Now, this gets to some other more technical questions. Does that mean every sentence you have in the book, should you footnote and give a description of exactly on what that's based? And I, in that book, did a bit of a compromise. But perhaps to guard against reviewers like that, you'd have to have footnotes on every single sentence in your book. But then, of course, few people would read it.
But this is interesting. You're both taking rather a hard line about capital T truth, and at the same time, for the reader, there's something wonderfully fluid in these microhistorical accounts and what you both do. You're drawing on, certainly you, Carlo, you draw on painting, Dante, literature. You both draw on anthropology, theory, and some of your writing surely reads like fiction, and your stories point to theater and cinema. I mean, is it not a kind of wonderfully open world that you're all working there?
Well, I mean, when I started writing history with my first book, I thought, well, my ambition would be to get two different audiences at the same time. A sort of, let's say, professional audience and a larger audience. How large? I don't know. Basically, I'm not willing to sacrifice any scholarly standard in my books. Any. I would like to keep all of them. On the other hand, there is a sort of desire to involve some larger audience, but actually I'm not interested in writing bestsellers so far. I think I will die without writing bestsellers. This is not my aim.
What's the future of microhistory? I mean, and how small can it get? Robert Darnton had a very successful book on the cat massacre in France. How local? How local, how provincial, how small socially can the story go? And when do we come back to the grand narratives?
Yeah, I think I could answer touching a different point. In other words, geography, the geography of microhistory. I mean, it would be possible to talk about translations, which are interesting in themselves. I mean, the translatability of a book like The Children and the Worms. And I think that, let's say, what the appeal was not only related to the narrative itself, but also to the fact that there are two major problems which are dealt with in the book and which can be experienced in any culture, meaning the confrontation with the authority, either political or religious, and, let's say, the interaction between written and oral culture. So I think that, let's say, this can circulate through a story, but there are those two major points. But then there is the geography of microhistory, meaning the spread of microhistory as a practice. And this is very interesting, because it started in Italy. Then there was a sort of first circle, Great Britain, France, Germany, the United States, and then a larger, different circle, Mexico, Denmark, and then another circle, Iceland. Now, this is not an anecdote, in my view, because the point is that countries which felt themselves at the periphery of world history took microhistory as an instrument in order to say, okay, well, if we are going to work on a case which is related to either to Hungary or to Iceland, could be, let's say, a case which would resonate with a much larger audience, because the point is about the approach, is not about the geography itself. So it's a way of reestablishing a sort of equality, in my view. That's the political point.
I want to say one last question. We were talking with Gordon Wood yesterday, a historian of 18th century America, and America in general, about a historical perspective on what feels like a historic election, 2008 in the United States. And he was saying, well, in most cases, the players on the field don't really know what's going on, and we'll tell them in 10, 20, 50, 100 years what was actually driving all this. But can you imagine a microhistorian's way to look at this election? For example, silly example perhaps, but to sort of find the town, the swing town in Ohio, or the editor of the paper in the swing town, or the cat in the office of the editor of the paper in the swing town in Ohio, that would somehow be worth unfolding in the style that you're making famous. Where would we go for a microhistorian's pinhole into the turmoil in this country today?
No recipes, but it can happen.
Point us.
Could be a village. But could be somebody working for the campaign for one of the candidates. And so his or her point of view. But the point would be to find something which is not known in advance. I'm not interested in the bizarre per se. And so the point would be to make a larger point, starting from a case study, which could be a village, or maybe, looking at one of the candidates. Why not? Because we should not take for granted their relevance. I think there can be a larger relevance, which is not immediately visible. So we can look at them, one of them, both of them, in a sort of, putting them under the microscope.
Mm. Any suggestions, David?
Well, just
how to understand 2008 in this country from a microhistorian's
mind.
This
is the disadvantage of being so close. But take just one example. Recently, a lot's been said about Western Pennsylvania, about racism and racial attitudes. And what do they go by? Well, on the one hand, you have surveys, and the other, you'll have a journalist who talks to someone and who'll say they're among their friends. People say they won't vote for Obama because of racial attitudes. So one can imagine, in a way, getting at this, and what might be very crucial, not so much through studying the election itself or even the campaign itself, but through some kind of, I might as anthropologists say, ethnography of changing racial attitudes and interactions and the difference between one thing I think both historians and anthropologists are particularly interested in at this level, difference between what people say and what they do. This is, I think, always an element of productive tension in history and certainly would be in doing this kind of contemporary microhistory on the election.
Thank you both enormously. What I take away is that it's not the small size of the story, it's the power of the microscope you bring to it. David Kircher, thank you enormously. And Carla Ginsburg, great pleasure to meet you finally.
Thank you. Thanks.